DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
Hello, good to have you with us. I'm Irene Quayle in Bonn. It's the Easter holiday weekend in many parts of the world. Traditionally, it's a time of feasting after several weeks of fasting in Christian regions. For many others across the Northern Hemisphere, it's time to celebrate the start of spring. One way or other, a holiday weekend is likely to involve good food and drink. But where does it come from and is it sustainable?
So there's over 200 factory trawlers who are licensed to fish in the Barents Sea, and the footprint on the environment in the ocean is very large.
Whether you live in Europe, the USA or China, the tasty cod on your table could be coming from the Arctic as climate change melts the sea ice, should that concern you. But you'd be okay eating cheese, or would you?
The biggest cow factory is in Saudi Arabia, so in the middle of the desert with the 85,000 animals. And this is crazy because it means that there is no link anymore between animals and nature.
And if you're looking for traditional lamb in this Living Planet holiday special, you won't find it cooked and on the menu. They're all out working and doing their own feasting in this Chilean vineyard.
During the spring summer, he has his lambs in the Andes Mountains, but when the winter arrives, there is no grass, there is too cold, so he came down here into this vineyard with 600 sheep or lambs, and they cut the grass, and they do that job.
Choice food and wine on the menu in this week's Living Planet. But did you know that up to a third of all the food produced worldwide is lost or wasted in food production and consumption practices? In the EU alone, more than 100 million tonnes of food is wasted every year. Some countries have decided it's time for action. Denmark recently opened a food waste supermarket that sells surplus products at discount prices. And France has just gone one step further. A new law has come into effect, making France the world's first country to ban supermarket waste. Lisa Bryant has been checking it out in Paris.
Vous voyez, les Rolls sont complètement vidés, mais ce sont des Rolls que les collaborateurs remplissent.
We're in a refrigerated room tucked into the bowels of a massive Carrefour supermarket in western Paris. Carts are piled high with food, packs of yogurt and chocolate pudding, slightly stale baguettes and pastries. In a few hours, charities will cart them away for distribution to the needy.
The associations come every day to take the products. We distribute 320,000 meals a year. Across France, that means 92 million meals for all of the Carrefour markets. That's enormous.
Director Soed Toumi says nothing is wasted in her store, but not all French supermarkets are so thrifty. The average store is estimated to throw away about 20 kilos daily of unsold food. Some reportedly poured bleach on their products to stop homeless people from eating them. That's changed under a new law that bans supermarket waste. It obligates large retailers to donate unsold but still edible food to charities and food banks. The rest must be recycled into products like animal feed or compost. For Carrefour customer Jean-Marie Gamas, the legislation is good news.
Before, big supermarkets were legally obliged to throw away the food, so there was enormous waste that was within the law.
The supermarket waste ban amounts to a victory for Arash Derambash, a municipal councillor in the Paris suburb of Courbevoie.
So the situation is very simple. We have got, in the one hand, in each supermarket, kilos of unsold food thrown away to the garbage. On the second hand, in front of this absurdity, we have got lots of millions, middle class, poor persons, on homeless persons.
Darren Bush knows what it's like to go hungry. As a student, he struggled to make ends meet. Last year, he and friends began collecting supermarket food and distributing it to the poor and launched a petition to get the supermarket waste ban into law. Now, he wants to take his campaign global.
I call all the states in Europe and lots of countries like USA, President Barack Obama, to pass the same law.
Many charities welcome the legislation. Louise Saint-Germain heads an association called Une Main Tendue pour Demain, which collects food from Carrefour for distribution to about 70 low-income households.
Alors, nous allons pouvoir récupérer beaucoup plus de denrées, certainement.
It will allow us to feed more people and provide a more diverse food basket. Every day, there are more people out of work. This helps them manage their budget and gives them the energy to fight to improve their daily lives and find work.
Pour améliorer leur quotidien et puis retrouver du travail.
Not surprisingly, low-income French also welcome the law. Elizabeth Bowden shops at a small grocery store run by the Salvation Army outside Paris. She pays just a fraction of the cost of her groceries, which are donated by local markets.
Franchement, oui, sincèrement.
It really helps a lot. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to make ends meet. There are so many needy people. All the more reason to share instead of throwing food away.
But Aline Chassagneau, who manages the Salvation Army grocery, is worried the law will lead to more food donations than charities can handle.
On n'a pas la capacité d'absorber l'ensemble de l'offre, en fait.
The real problem is we simply don't have the technical and logistical capacity to distribute more food to more people. And we are not the only ones.
Distribuer plus, tout simplement. Et on n'est pas les seuls.
Back at the Carrefour market, Director Toomey says staff are trained to avoid wasting food.
Dans notre magasin, nous avons une équipe.
We have a team that's dedicated to sorting the merchandise daily, fresh and packaged products. The charities come to collect them.
Les associations viennent tous les jours pour récupérer ces produits.
Donc là, je les trempe. Ils sont imbibés de sirop, ça les a.
In the kitchen, pastry chefs use unsold fruit to decorate cakes. Day-old croissant and pain au chocolat are turned into almond pastries. Food past its prime is transformed into biofuel that powers Carrefour's trucks.
Pourquoi pas encore une fois si cette loi qui peut devenir européenne.
Why not have a European law that can help more distributors? We need to function this way. It's a state of mind for the citizens as well.
C'est un état d'esprit et c'est aussi un état d'esprit citoyen.
Charities agree with that philosophy. Beyond a supermarket waste law, the Salvation Army's Aline Chassagneau believes French need to rethink their consumption and sharing practices, taking into account the dignity of the poor. And that, she says, is not so simple. Lisa Bryant, DW, Paris.
European fish markets have sold a lot of Atlantic cod this winter. At least 70% of all the Atlantic cod that ends up in supermarkets around the world comes from the Barents Sea, off the northern coasts of Norway and Russia. As climate change melts the Arctic sea ice, industrial fishing fleets are advancing further north. Good news for fish and chip lovers, perhaps, but a Greenpeace study suggests there are grounds for concern. Frida Bengtsson is the author. I asked her what she'd found out.
What we've seen over the years is that the cod fishery that comes from Norway, that supplies markets in Europe, but also we see it traveling as far into China, Latin America, North America, has been expanding further north. So we can see that the fish is now being caught further and further north and moving into the Arctic.
So why is that a bad thing?
The bad thing with that is that these areas have previously been covered by sea ice. And if we look in the Norwegian Arctic and in the Barents Sea, we can see that that's the area in the Arctic that's mostly affected by loss of sea ice. And up to half of the sea ice cover in the Barents Sea has disappeared since the 1980s.
Now, if we assume that the sea ice is disappearing anyway, what's the problem with getting the fish?
So under that sea ice, research has just started to look into what's below on the seabed. And the little glimpse we've had of that seabed so far show us that these ecosystems are relatively intact. They've found things that they haven't found in other parts of the Barents Sea where extensive fishing has taken place.
So, in fact, you are more worried about the other species than about the fish themselves?
Yeah, it's a very big fishery. So there's over 200 factory trawlers who are licensed to fish in the Barents Sea, and the footprint on the environment in the ocean is very large. So we're concerned that if this fishery is allowed to move into areas that haven't been fished before, it will have a very negative impact. We're mostly concerned about bottom trawling, which is a fishing method when you use heavy trawl doors that can weigh several hundred kilos to put the net open, and then you drag it along the seabed along with chains. And of course, these creatures that stand on the seabed are very vulnerable and soft. And when they're being hit by these massive trawls, they're being destroyed.
So what kind of preventive measures would you like to see?
So we think that, first of all, industry should move out of these areas already now. And what we also want to see is that Norway steps up and actually protects these areas.
Now, alongside Norway, another major player in the region is Russia. Are you also targeting them?
The interesting with the Barents Sea fishery is that most the fishery is shared between Norway and Russia, and most of the fishing activity actually takes place inside Norway. But the thing is that the Russians have already acknowledged the vulnerability for their part and have notified that as sensitive areas.
Now, there's just been a new initiative by the US and Canada, President Obama and Prime Minister Trudeau, to safeguard the Arctic. Will that affect fishing in any way?
We really hope so. I think it's a fantastic statement, and I think it really shows some clear and good leadership when it comes to Arctic protection. And we think now that it's a lot up to sort of implementation of those nice words. And when we saw the Trudeau and Obama statement that they say that at least 10%, so we're hoping that they will set the bar really high on protection, and that fishing will, of course, also be included in the way that you will create these areas in the Arctic that will be off limits to any industrial activity, including oil and gas.
So one thing is government action. You also mentioned the industry. What motivation would there be for industry to impose controls on itself?
Because people that we talk to, and I think also the response we got into on this report is very clear. People don't consider that trawling for cod in the Arctic is something that is sustainable. And I think in the terms of industry, I think it's important for them to be in the forefront of sustainability. And I think that's the drive we see. And I think that's also what the indications we have from industry is suggesting, that they also consider this important and want to take preventive measures, which is interesting because it sort of falls around the same pattern as we've seen other places on the planet, for example, around the soya moratorium in Brazil, when industry also kind of agreed to take preventive measures to not expand soya production into the Amazon. And for us, this is a very similar case, to not expand industrial fisheries into the Arctic.
Now, what about the individual consumer? What should I be looking out for? Is there a way that I can find out whether my fish comes from an area of the Arctic where it should not be coming from or not?
Unfortunately, today that is very difficult for a consumer. But even if it is difficult, I think it's always very, very important to ask the question, because if more and more consumers start asking the question, where is my fish from, that will then lead to better labelling. We have seen in Europe initiatives where some fish is labelled with catching area and actually the fishing boat. But unfortunately, that's a very small share. But we would, of course, would like to see that happening in the entire seafood market, and not only with cod in this case, but also other things. But the most important thing for now as a consumer is to ask where the fish comes from.
Frida Bengtsson from Greenpeace on the line there from Norway. Cheese is a staple on many of our tables, and more than 2,000 varieties exist throughout the world. And the difference is not just in the taste. Slow Food, a global organisation for the protection of biodiversity and local food cultures and traditions, says the kind of cheese you pick can have a radically different impact on the environment. Italy is home to a huge range of tasty cheeses. Danny Mitzman went along to a cheese fair in Bra, in the northwest of the country, to sample some of the products and find out the background.
Our goal is to explain that milk is not one product.
Serena Milano works for the Slow Food Foundation for Biodiversity. They've organised an exhibition to give visitors an idea of global milk production and the differences between industrially produced and artisanal cheeses.
We are speaking about two different opposite worlds. In the artisanal system, you start from the soil, from the grasses, the animals, and all the cycle is healthy. If you have a big factory, you have industrial food from the beginning, then you need veterinary treatments, so antibiotics, so you lose the taste, but also the nutritional value. You have another product.
Serena describes how the drive for efficiency and quantity has led industrial dairies down a radically different path from traditional dairy farming.
The biggest cow factory is in Saudi Arabia, so in the middle of the desert, with the 85,000 animals. And this is crazy because it means that there is no link anymore between animals and nature, animals and land and water and grass. It's just a factory, like metal factories.
Serena points out some large jars on display. Two contain fragrant hay and straw, two more contain unpleasant-smelling cattle feed.
If you have an industrial system, it means that you need a lot of food for these animals. And so, for example, in Europe, we import tons and tons of soya and corn from Brazil and from US. This means that we are going toward monocultures, and we use the land for animals' feed and not for families, communities' consumption. This means deforestation, means a massive use of pesticides and chemical fertilizers. Then there is the transport of all these corn and soybeans, and at the end, that means also pollution.
As well as the huge environmental and social impact, Serena says animal biodiversity is also at risk. While dairy farmers used to use an enormous variety of breeds, today more than three-quarters of the world's cows are just one breed, Holstein Friesians. While most breeds can produce an average of 10 to 15 litres of milk per day, Friesians can produce 60. Today they constitute more than 90% of cows in Canada and the USA, and a very high percentage in Europe too.
More or less one-third of the traditional breeds are at risk of extinction, and probably in 10 years we will lose them. And when we lose a breed, we lose it forever.
Slow Food is working to catalogue local traditional breeds at risk of extinction and traditional cheeses made with their milk. One of those is Bito Storico, made high up in the alpine pastures of the Prealps in the north Italian Lombardy region.
Bito Storico is exactly representative of what Slow Food recommends. A good natural product, but also respect for the environment, the animals, artisanal work and preserving traditions.
Albino Mazzolini explains how their cheese is made by practicing the centuries-old mountain tradition of transhumance, the seasonal movement of livestock.
The transhumance is vertical because they set off from 1,400 metres at the beginning of June and reach 2,100 metres by the end of August, beginning of September. We get the animals to eat all the grass. This is very important from an environmental perspective. We don't use animal feed. The reason Bito Storico has always fought against the use of feed is because where you give feed, animals no longer graze in the pastures. If animals don't graze, you lose the pasture and lose the nature.
L'alpeggio, perdere la natura.
Bito Storico is 90% cow's milk, 10% goat's. The goats are the indigenous endangered Orobica breed. The traditional indigenous cow is the original brown.
But unfortunately, in the last 10 years, because of incorrect policy decisions, which focus more on quantity rather than quality of milk, they've been substituted by breeds which aren't really suited to alpine pastures. Today, by paying more to producers who have the original breeds to make their cheese, we are trying to get producers to return to the original brown. We now have several producers who've now got entire herds of original browns.
From the same alpine region as Bitto Storico, former goat farmer Enrico Benedetti makes a pure Orobica goat's milk cheese. While passionate about protecting the environment, he's also realistic about the financial implications.
Il discorso economico non è tanto, voglio dire, un pochettino basso il discorso economico.
The economic aspect is pretty poor, and that's probably why so few young people want to follow in our footsteps. We need regional financial support and understanding of our problems. If they don't help, our mountains will be abandoned, and then what happens? Natural disasters. Without human labor, if there are storms but nobody fixes the walls and riverbanks, calamities can happen.
Danny Nitzman for DW in Bra, northwest Italy.
To go along with that cheese, you might want a glass of wine. And here too, there are huge differences in the environmental impact of the production process. Chile has some of the world's best growing conditions for wine, with cool nights and hot days. In the 1990s, the country used to produce vast quantities of cheap wine, which it sold to Europe and the United States. But now, wine growers are changing their focus. They want to ensure that they're looking after the land and the people who work for them. 57 vineyards have signed up to the Sustainability Code. DW's reporter Jane Chambers went to meet Gerardo Leal, Santa Rita's vineyard manager at Alto Quedal, to have a look at how they're putting the code into practice.
Behind us we've got rows and rows of vines, but in front of us I can see some corn cobs growing. I can see a patch of what looks like flowers, a mix of flowers, grass, might say weeds.
This is a special project. We create this project for the worker here, so they can produce different crops in this area, like corns, tomatoes, potatoes, different things. They collect these crops and they can sell them to other people or to the restaurant here, because in the tourist part here we have a restaurant, the park, special tours for the people. And this is a part of our compromise with the workers here.
So that they can earn some more money by doing that.
Exactly.
So we're driving along quite a bumpy road now between the vineyard and the other crops that some of the workers are growing. Where are we off to next?
We're planning to go to the upper part of the vineyard, where we can see, you know, the whole valley. To get this place, we need to cross this forest with different kind of trees, native trees. We keep this forest because it's very important for our sustainable way. We don't have too much peasant diseases, but one way to decrease the use of chemical products is trying to keep, you know, the natural forest or the natural trees around the vineyard in the same environment.
Back in Santiago, I'm off to meet Patricio Parra, who works for a company called Vinos de Chile and is in charge of sustainability. 70% of all wine that Chile produces is signed up for the Sustainability Code. I want to know why Chile decided to focus on this area.
We want to protect our natural resources for the future, and at the same time we are very committed with the social conditions and the workers' condition. But it's quite clear also from the external market, they are requiring more commitment with sustainability. The consumers are more aware about the issues related with environment and social conditions of working.
And so what countries would you say those are that you're selling to that care about that?
Yeah, it's mainly Europe, European countries. But it's a trend in terms of in the United States, in Canada also, the consumers require more commitment from the companies in terms of sustainability.
Viña Emiliana is one of the many Chilean wine producers that takes part in the Sustainability Code. Up in the hills at the foot of the Andes Mountains, I met Noelia Orts, who's head winemaker at their vineyard, Los Robles.
She told me that they look after their environment by not using any weed killers or pesticides. Instead, they've come up with an interesting way to keep weeds out of the vineyards.
In the flat areas, we work with horses, right? And then in other areas, much more difficult for the horses, we use machines. We cut the grass with machines. But in Chile, mostly of the rain comes in winter, and then we have a lot of weed in that moment. And because the soils are wet, you cannot go inside with machines. What we do is we have an agreement with a shipperman that during the spring and summer, he has his lambs in the Andes Mountains, but when the winter arrives, there is no grass, there is too cold, so he came down here into this vineyard with 600 sheep or lambs, and they cut the grass. We move the lambs from one block to another, and they do that job. They cut the grass, they give manure, imagine, and because they are lighter than a cow, for example, they don't compact the soil. So three benefits in one.
Back at Alto Jerel, I went to discover how they're making changes in their production process to become more efficient in their use of energy, water, and the materials they use for the bottles. Wow, I am overwhelmed by a very strong smell of wine. That's because we've got huge barrels in front of us and we've come to the wine production place and we're going to have a look at how this has been made sustainable as well. Who have I got with me?
Agustín Castillo.
And what is your job here?
Production manager.
You can probably hear all the machines. This is very much the kind of factory part of production.
The principal change that we make in the last 3 years, we change all our motor to reduce the consumption of energy between 15 to 20%. We reduce near of the 30% of the water that we use. And in the last 3 years, we move all our bottle to the new kind of bottle, the eco bottle, and we reduce between 100 and 150 grams per bottle. And for us, that we produce near of 80 million bottles is a lot of tons of glass that we reduce.
It's beautiful. It's like this amazing, beautiful colonial building. You can probably hear we've got cobbles on the floors, big high ceilings, amazing wooden, huge chunky wooden doors. We've got bottles and bottles of wine in front of us.
This is the wine tasting room. For visitors, it's really nice. You can see, you know, the whole of collections, all of level of wine from Santa Rita.
So I've come outside from the wine tasting room and in front of me there are three tourists from the United States who are taking part in a wine tasting session.
My name is Heidi and I'm from Rhode Island.
And what brings you to Santa Rita today?
I've drunk Santa Rita Rhine back in the States, so when I had the opportunity to come here and tour the vineyard, I thought it would be a beautiful way to spend half the day.
One of the big things about Santa Rita is its sustainability code. So the idea that they look after the environment, they look after their workers, they think about how they produce their wine. Is that something that's important to you as someone who buys their wine? And if so, why?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. My background is actually the sciences. So anyone that cares about the environment and how to be sustainable in their business with social responsibility is very important to me. So I applaud any company that carries forth and believes in those same values and principles.
Customers like Heidi are very much in Chilean wine producers' minds when they decide to sign up for the sustainability code. They know that not only do they need to care for their land to preserve it for future generations, but they also need to think about the people who buy their wine. In recent years, there's been a significant shift towards social responsibility, and consumers are really thinking about the origin and process of where their produce comes from. Jane Chambers, DW, Santiago.
And that brings us to the end of this week's holiday menu. If you'd like a second helping, you can download episodes of Living Planet or replay them online at dw.com/environment, where you also find some dessert in the form of a few other environment stories. You can also listen to our reports and features on iTunes and on SoundCloud. I'm Irene Quayle. From all of us here in Bonn, Until next time, bye for now.